Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel. And today, we are in the presence of greatness. I'm honored to be talking to Professor Marcus Rediker. Dr. Marcus Rediker is a distinguished professor of Atlantic history at the University of Pittsburgh. His histories from below, including The Slave Ship, A Human History, have won numerous awards, including George Washington Book Prize, and have been translated into 17 languages worldwide. He has also produced a film called Ghosts of Amistad with director Tony Buba, if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, and written a play, The Return of Benjamin Lay. And today he's here to talk to us about his magnum opus, The Slave Ship, A Human History. Marcus, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I should probably say welcome back. You've been here before, and I'm really glad to be able to talk to you about this book. It's normally customary to ask our guests to introduce themselves, but you're quite well known. You've been here before, so I'll just get to the questions about the book.
Let's go.
I'm kind of curious to know about the title of the book. Do you call this A Slave Ship, A Human History? And also, it's a history from below. Can you tell us why you call it A Human History? And then give us a definition of history from below.
Sure. When I began to think about writing this book, one of my concerns was that the history of the slave trade had become too statistical. And I'm one who believes in the importance of quantitative analysis, but if what you understand the slave trade to be consists primarily of mortality rates and length of voyage and things like that, something profound is missing. And what's missing is the fact that this is a history that happened to real human beings. So I chose the subtitle, A Human History, because I felt that if we're really going to wrestle with this history, and I think we must wrestle with it if we're to imagine a better future, that those quantitative studies don't help us to wrestle. They, in fact, sanitize the history in very serious ways. So I felt that for moral and political reasons, we needed a human history. Now, as you say, the kind of history that I do has been called history from below. It's also sometimes called a radical history or people's history. But what that implies is that it's a kind of social history, but a specific kind, in that you look at the people, you try to see things from the point of view of the ordinary working people who are involved in the period of study. And in this case, that involves looking from the lower deck, looking at the experience of the tens of millions of enslaved people, most of them from West Africa, to see what their experience was, and to the extent that we can recover it, find out what they thought about that experience. This is very important because history from below is about consciousness. It's about subjectivity. It's about voice when you can find it. And especially, maybe most especially, it's treating people who have normally been left out of the top-down narratives, not only as subjects of history, but as makers of history. So this is one of the things I wanted to explore. And this history from below also takes into account the sailors on board the slave ship, who many of whom were captive laborers themselves. So I wanted to understand their part. And then, of course, I also wanted to understand the officers, and especially the slave ship captains, and even the merchants. So it really is a view of almost all of the people who were involved in slave ships. And the effort is to present that in a way that makes those people real. Real people under real circumstances, making real decisions in real time. So that was my goal.
And as you said, the problem with quantitative, not the problem, really, it's kind of abstract, it's numbers. I've read a lot about the history of slavery, but reading your book, it just gives us that human story. Some of the people that that are in your book, we don't even know their names, but the memory lives with us, and that's the a very powerful part of the book, one of the great part of the book. Talk a little bit about this aspect of slavery, its slave ship. This aspect of, there has been a lot written about slavery, but not really about slave ship and what happens to the slaves while they're on the ship. So why is that? Why is that this part of the history has been sort of neglected?
Well, Morteza, let me begin by saying that I think that the scholarship that's been done on slavery, and let's include within that slave resistance, is probably the best body of scholarship done anywhere in the world over the last 60 years or so. What we know about slavery in so many different parts of the world right now is just stunning. And of course, there remains a gap between what the scholars know and what the general public knows. We've got to close that gap. But given that, it's even more surprising that we had so few studies of the slave ship. In other words, we've got hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of studies of the plantation and plantation systems. Well, the plantation and the slave ship are the two essential institutions, you might say, of the Atlantic slave system. You can't have one without the other. So why is it that we have so many of one and so few of the other? And first of all, I'd say that most historians of slavery are not accustomed to working with maritime sources. I think that's an issue. I had been working in maritime sources for 30 years before I started this book. That was actually kind of a flying head start. I had already gathered a lot of evidence about slave ships in, for example, court records in the Admiralty courts in England and around the empire. So that was important. Most people are unfamiliar with sources. Secondly, and I think probably more importantly, there's a kind of bias built into our thinking that makes it harder to see ships as historic spaces and instruments. And what I mean by that is we have a kind of bias, a very modern bias, quite uninspected, that history happens on land. And usually it happens in nation states. So landed history and national history, they have become naturalized. That's the way we see the past. Now, I worked on seafaring subjects for many, many years, and I was trying to come up with a way to describe this bias, and I finally coined a term called terracentrism, that our histories were terracentric. And the problem with this is that it sort of implicitly posits that the oceans of the world are not historical spaces, that history somehow doesn't happen at sea. But of course, we know very well that history happens at sea. I mean, this is not true for all areas of inquiry. For example, history of exploration, naval history, they know that history happens at sea. But most national histories do not. So when you think about it, and this is one of the big themes of this book, it's important to understand that huge and important global historical processes happen at sea. Class formation happens at sea. Race formation happens at sea. Cultural formation happens at sea. And if you can't see the oceans of the world as a place where history happens, you're missing out on some really powerful formative elements. I mean, how can you write the history of capitalism without taking seafaring into account? This is what created the world market. So that's why I was very keen to add this kind of study to this extraordinary pantheon of work on the history of slavery.
Let's talk about the scope of the book. So you talk about Atlantic slave trade. So what time period do you take into account in this book? And can you, I know that there are not accurate estimates, but can you give us a rough estimate how many slaves were captured in that time period?
I can. Yeah, I study British and American slave ships in a slightly elongated 18th century. From roughly 1700 to 1807. 1807 is when the British abolished the slave trade. 1808 is when the United States abolishes the slave trade. So that seemed an apt terminus. But of course, the trade goes on for another 50 to 60 years, especially among Portuguese slavers. But basically, I study this 100 years plus, and this is in some ways the peak period of the slave trade. And the peak carrier in the peak period was Great Britain. During this period of a little over 100 years, they carried almost 3 million people into bondage. At the same time, the Portuguese were carrying almost a like number, slightly fewer. The United States, or the American colonies, we should say, up until 1783, carried a much smaller number of about 300,000. But in this period that I've chosen, we're looking at something well more than a quarter of the total number of 12 plus million who were carried across the Atlantic in the Middle Passage.
When the numbers are staggering. And there's a database. I was listening to one of your lectures some time ago, and there was this database which was fascinating, accurate record of the slave ships and how many slaves they carried. Yeah, I don't remember the name of the database, but I've saved it somewhere on my computer. Let's talk about the structure of the slave ship first, because the way it's written in the book, it's not really a ship. It's a huge piece of technology built, and it's a main instrument of capitalism. But we'll talk about this aspect later on. Can you tell us, describe what a slave ship looked like, and how do we know this truck? Is there any slave ship left in a museum somewhere, or are there any records of that anywhere?
Mm-hmm. Let me say before I answer that question that the project that you're mentioning is called the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database. It is available online at slavevoyages.org. And this is a compilation of data on 36,000 different slaving voyages from roughly 1500 to the 1860s. Almost 400 years, and that's actually a significant thing for your listeners to think about. This went on for almost 400 years. So I do encourage people to visit that. I think this is a great scholarly achievement, and it was very important to my own research. So the slave ship. Now, the first thing to be said about the slave ship is that any kind of vessel could be a slave ship, from a tiny vessel to a huge ship. I mean, there are ships that will carry only 20 or 25 enslaved people. These are like small sloops, single-masted vessels. But then you have on the other end these massive ships that could carry 800 or 900 enslaved people at a time. So the first thing to know is that practically any kind of vessel could be adapted to the slave trade. But beginning in the 18th century, there did come to be a specific kind of vessel. This evolved in relation to the demand for slaves in the plantation societies of the New World. And this vessel was especially important in a place like Liverpool, which was the leading slave trading port in the world at that time. So the shipwrights of Liverpool, and then other places too, would build a certain kind of ship that they thought was especially well suited for the slave trade. These would be ships of about 200, 250 tons. That's not their weight, that's their carrying capacity. The average number of enslaved people on board a vessel for the full totality of the trade is a little more than 300. That would consist of 15 to 20 different ethnicities or nationalities. But in order to accommodate these people and specifically to control them, this technology, and this is what it was, the ship was, I think, the most important technology to the rise of capitalism. They would build ships with certain features. One of the main features was these vessels had double decks. They had the main deck like every other ship, but they had another deck down below it, which is where you would hold all of the captured Africans. They would be jammed in there in really kind of horrifying ways. But these places, these lower decks, this is where enslaved people spent 16 and sometimes more hours every day on an Atlantic crossing that could take months at a time. So the double deck, the lower deck, that's a specific feature of the slave ship. They will also have other important features, one of which is that between decks on that lower deck, there would be holes cut in the side of the vessel, cut in the hull. These were basically airports so that the human cargo could breathe. I mean, if you were carrying a cargo such as textiles or sugar or something like that, you wouldn't cut holes in the side of the ship. But since you had to get this, you know, people had to be able to breathe, there are holes. You can actually see these in some of the depictions of the slave ships. Another feature of slave ships is that they had on the main deck around the rails of the ship, they had netting. And this netting was basically there to prevent enslaved Africans from jumping overboard to commit suicide, because this was very common. So there's netting to prevent that kind of resistance. And then another feature, which would usually be constructed by the ship's carpenter. In other words, it might not be there when the ship came out of the shipyard, but the ship's carpenter would construct what was called a barricado, which is basically a defensive bulwark between the ship, sort of midship, you might say, a place to which, behind which, the crew could retreat in case there was an insurrection on board the vessel. And there were lots of uprisings. At the top of this barricado would be mounted guns so that the crew could fire down on the people who were rising up in resistance. So those are some of the main features of the slave ship. Now, there is no such vessel that has survived. I mean, the average wooden sailing ship has a life of, you know, 30 years or so. But there is a set of plans that were left, actually by a French shipwright for a vessel called the Aurora. So we can see exactly how a slave ship was constructed based on these plans. I think this vessel dates from the late 18th century and was probably sailing out of the port of Nantes in France.
How long did each voyage take on average, with like sometimes 300, 400, or 500 people on board?
Okay, well, here's how. One of the things that people have frequently asked me is, you've made this argument that a kind of bonding takes place among the Africans on the lower deck. How could that possibly happen when they're just making a single passage? Well, here's what you need to know. It took a long time for a slave ship captain on the west coast of Africa to gather up a full human cargo. The average was about 8 months. So if you were one of the early people to come on board one of these vessels, then you're probably going to be on that vessel for 10 or 11 months, right? So they're slowly adding people. They're buying, the slave ship captains in the 18th century will buy enslaved people, usually a small number at a time, 5, 10, 15 at a time in most parts of West Africa. And then they would move down the coast to get people from another ethnic group that was presumably spoke a different language. So there was a deliberate mixing of languages to prevent people from cooperating. Okay, that's actually an important thing to understand. Now, how long the Middle Passage took varied tremendously depending on where the voyage began and where it ended. The shortest Middle Passage was between the Congo-Angola region of West Central Africa and Brazil. And if you see that on a map, that's much closer than the voyages that might be made from, let's say, what's now Ghana, what was then called the Gold Coast, to a place like Jamaica. That might take 10, 11, 12 weeks, sometimes longer. It would depend on the winds. So the time spent on the ship is really significant.
And that idea that you mentioned, this bonding between the slaves, you call it fictive kinship, that you borrowed this expression from another scholar, fictive kinship. I'm really keen to know more about how slaves were treated. It's a very broad question, of course. So how they were treated, what were the acts of rebellion, how did they put up resistance? And there's a quote in your book, I'll just read it. It said, in producing workers for the plantation, the ship factory also produced race. So that's, you also argue that these acts of, let's say, fictive kinships, the idea of race also was formed on board, because these people did not even speak the same language. It's a broad question, but I would appreciate it if you could talk about it.
No, it's actually several questions.
Yes.
let's begin with treatment. The treatment was violent in the extreme. That's because slave ship captains realized that they had to practice terror against the enslaved in order to try to keep them manageable, so to speak. In other words, there were calculated uses of violence that were central to shipboard life. So that's kind of the first point. The second point is the extreme crowding on the lower deck. I think it was William Wilberforce, the British abolitionist, who said, never has so much human misery been concentrated in so small a space. So hundreds and hundreds of people down on the lower deck. What happens if an epidemic should break out? Well, then very many people can die. The average mortality rate for the Middle Passage is around 12% for the full life of the slave trades, which means that about one person out of eight would die on a given voyage. That for a typical voyage with 300 people, that would be quite a few people more who would die. And every morning, the sailors would go down to the lower deck and bring up the corpses of those who had died overnight, and they would throw them over the rails to the schools of sharks that would follow the vessels across the Atlantic. I actually looked into this, but you know, abolitionists made a lot of these sharks. I talked to ichthyologists to see, was it true that sharks would follow a vessel like this? They said, absolutely. Sharks are easily trained to a source of food. So this was the nightmarish stuff of this voyage. The treatment is horrific. In that context, and this I think is the most important thing to understand about the slave trade, people fought back in every conceivable way. I mean, I was actually stunned to see how creative they were in figuring out how to fight back. For example, you could make the argument that the slave trade was a 400-year hunger strike. One of the things that people could do would be to refuse to eat, and lots of people did that. And there are instances in which mistreatment of the enslaved, which was frequent, common, would create a hunger strike in response. So this is a very important kind of resistance. People, despite those nettings around the rails, would find ways to climb up them or cut them and get through them and commit suicide by jumping into the Atlantic, knowing that they were going to be eaten alive by sharks. But there was a belief that underlay this action, the belief being that many West African people believed that when you died, your soul went home to your own village, to your own place. This was called going home to Guinea, which was a common word used for West Africa at that time. So suicide is a significant form of resistance. And then it turns out that there are vastly more insurrections than we realized. For the longest time, a scholar seemed to be stuck on the idea that there were 55 slave uprisings. Now we know there were many hundreds of them, and we're talking only about the ones that resulted in significant loss of life. So I think one out of every 10 voyages, and probably more because we don't always have the data, had a major uprising of some kind, despite the fact that these vessels are designed to prevent that kind of thing. The resistance goes on. So the resistance, I've argued, becomes a language among a multi-ethnic collection of people. In other words, if you see someone engaging in a hunger strike, if you see someone trying to get out of their chains so they can rise up and try to capture the ship, it doesn't matter what language you speak. You see this action of resistance, and that then becomes a unifying bond. And what I think is formed is a culture of resistance on board these ships. That culture of resistance will be carried off the ship when the Middle Passage ends and be very important to the formation of landed cultures of resistance. So that's very crucial. But maybe the most important kind of resistance is this fictive kinship. This is a concept that anthropologists have used for quite a while. It's basically invented kinship. It's not biological kinship. And of course, the people who found themselves on board a slave ship came from societies that were governed by kinship, but those ties had been shattered. So what we find people doing on board the ships is developing a new language of kinship around the idea of shipmate. The people who come over with you on the Middle Passage become your shipmates. They become your brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles. And that actually also is taken ashore, whereby if you end up on a plantation, let's say you build a family, you have children, you would instruct your children to call your former shipmate aunt or uncle. So it's this re-knitting together of kinship relations, which I find to be not only creative, but inspiring, that people are really trying to rebuild something under these horrific conditions, and they manage to do it. They're also speaking new languages. They're dancing new dances. They're singing new songs. There is a process of cultural formation going on in these horrific conditions on the lower deck. If you look at that process from the western side of the Atlantic, we might call it Pan-African. If you look at it from the eastern side of the Atlantic, we might call it African-American, not in a national sense, but in a hemispheric sense, so that these new cultures are being formed out of these disparate elements of many different West African cultures. And this is life-affirming. This is all about trying to survive under difficult circumstances. And I think this is one of the most powerful lessons in studying the slave trade, that despite the extremity of the violence and the terror, people fought back.
There is this former slave that you talk about in your book, Olada Equiano, who, if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, who became an abolitionist and also wrote his own autobiography in 1789, if I'm not mistaken. Can you talk about him? Who was Olada Equiano, and what sort of things did he describe in his autobiography?
Olada Equiano, who was also known by the name of Gustavus Vasa, that was a name that he took later, but when he wrote his autobiography, he wanted to use his African name. Was a man who was born in what is presently Nigeria. His ethnicity was Igbo. He was taken on board a slave ship at around the age of 10 or 11. So he had a child's perspective in the slave ship, but he does give us the point of view of the people who were going aboard these vessels for the first time. And what he said is kind of revealing. He said, when I first saw the ship, I mean, he had come from inland, so he hadn't seen any vessels. But he said, I was filled with astonishment to see this thing. And anybody who's seen these replica ships knows how kind of big and complex and powerful they were. And then he said, and quickly my astonishment turned to terror. Once he got on board the vessel, he saw that this vessel was ruled by the techniques of terror. For example, a sailor offered him some food, and he was feeling queasy and a little sick, as you might imagine. So he waved that he didn't want any food. The sailor thought that he was deliberately refusing food and striking, going on a hunger strike. So he got lashed. He got whipped for it. So this kind of thing happened very, very frequently. Alauda Equiano went across the Atlantic. He ended up living in several different places. He was enslaved, but he did manage to gain his freedom, not least because he was able to work as a sailor and get some money. So self-purchase was one avenue to freedom. And when the abolitionist movement began in the 1780s, it became clear that that movement really needed an African voice. So Alauda Equiano, as you say, in 1789, wrote a very powerful and popular autobiography recounting his experiences with slavery. This is, I think this is one of the most important literary works of the abolitionist movement. And he himself was extremely popular, going all around Great Britain on the circuit of abolitionist lectures, talking about, you know, what had happened to him. He helped to make the slave trade real to people. And that, I think, is a very important thing about his recollection. I should mention there has been a controversy about whether Equiano was actually from Africa, as he claimed. There are a couple of pieces of evidence to suggest that he might have been born in Carolina, South Carolina. But I, and I think quite a few other scholars, have rejected that suggestion, because I don't think it was in any way possible for him to know what he knew about Igbo culture unless he had been born into it. So he is a voice of the voiceless, we might say, for the slave trade.
Let's talk about some of the stories in the book. One of the most powerful and moving parts of the book was the story of the unknown woman who was thrown overboard, over the ship called Polly. And the captain of the ship was James Dwolf. And there was this sailor, right, John Cranston, who... Anyway, I'm not going to ruin the story because you're the historian. So I'll leave it to you to tell us that story.
Yes, the story of Polly is a very moving one. Polly was a woman who was on a voyage commanded by Captain James DeWolf, who was not only a slave ship captain, but a very wealthy slave trading merchant. And during the Middle Passage, coming across the Atlantic from the Gold Coast, present-day Ghana, Polly came down with what was believed to be the smallpox. So Captain DeWolf summoned his sailors and said, "Help me throw this woman overboard so that the other slaves won't catch the sickness." And what was really remarkable is that the sailors refused. They said, "We'll not do it." So they turned their backs on the captain. So the captain and his cabin boy tied the woman into a chair and then used a hoist to basically move her overboard and drop her into the water. She was tied up in the chair and she was gagged. That was to prevent her from crying out so that the other enslaved people couldn't hear her. So this woman was effectively murdered, by the slave ship captain. The vessel was the voyage was completed, went to Rhode Island, and somehow this man, John Cranston, ended up swearing a deposition in a local court describing this murder. Now, I don't know exactly how he ended up in court. My guess is that he met some abolitionists, and they heard the story, and so they encouraged him to come forward. Now, it took a lot of courage to take on someone like James DeWolfe. He was a very powerful man. But this sailor, John Cranston, did testify before the grand jury, and a copy of his testimony survives. And I read it, and it's extraordinary. He describes all of these things, and the foreman of the grand jury asks him, what did Captain DeWolfe say after the woman was hoisted overboard? And John Cranston said, Captain DeWolfe said he was sorry to lose so good a chair. So this gives you the wanton cruelty involved in this kind of thing. John Cranston disappears on the waterfront, and James DeWolfe ends up beating the charges. He's never actually tried for murder, although he should have been, but he was a powerful man, and he does go on to become a United States senator. He is one of the wealthiest people in all of early America. He made all of his money in the slave trade. I estimated that his vessels probably carried at least 10,000 people into bondage, because his vessels made dozens and dozens of Atlantic crossings. And I might mention, my dear friend Naomi Wallace, the playwright, wrote a play based on this story about James DeWolfe. It's called The Liquid Plain, and she and I worked together on this play. I was her historical consultant. And what she wrote to me was, as long as we keep telling the story of this woman tied into the chair, she'll never die. She keeps rising up out of the water again and again and again. So I was very glad that that particular story found a literary expression in her play.
Yeah, and like you said, this was one of the most moving parts of the book. I read the story, and I was just horrified. And I actually wanted to ask you about, at the end of the interview, I wanted to ask you about the play, because I know that you've been writing about this on your Facebook page, and I wanted to ask you about the play, which you just mentioned. And I think it's going to be played somewhere on the stage soon, right?
That's actually a different play.
Oh, I see.
Because after Naomi and I, Wallace and I, worked on this play, The Liquid Plain, which is about the slave trade, we decided to write a play based on another one of my books called The Fearless Benjamin Lay, the Quaker dwarf who became the first revolutionary abolitionist, a man who would spatter fake blood on the heads of slaveholders to humiliate them in public. So we have been working for several years on that play, and it will open in London at the Finborough Theater on June 13th, 2023.
Earlier in the interview, you mentioned that some of the sailors didn't even like to be on board. They had to, and there is one sailor, James Stanfield, that you talk about in the book. He became an abolitionist later. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
He's a fascinating figure, and I must say was not at all well known for many, many years. James Field Stanfield was like lots of other people. He ended up kind of on a slave ship more or less by mistake. He didn't really know what he was getting into. He was a member of the crew. He was a common sailor. He went through a horrific voyage of extremely high mortality. People don't know it, but the mortality among the crews was usually as high and sometimes higher than the mortality among the enslaved. And on Stanfield's voyage, I think a crew of 40 went out. That was a fairly common number of sailors to have on board a ship, and only three of them came back to Liverpool alive. So when, some years later, the great abolitionist Thomas Clarkson is looking for people who have direct experience of the slave trade. He goes to Liverpool, to Bristol, to London to talk with sailors to find out what was their experience on board the ship. He finds out about Stanfield, and Stanfield writes an account of his time at sea, a very moving and sympathetic account of the horrors on board the ship. He also wrote an epic poem about the slave trade. So Stanfield is one of the people who helped to educate the middle and upper class abolitionists like Clarkson and Wilberforce, who are usually given credit for building the abolition movement. Well, the truth is they knew almost nothing about the slave trade. They had to find people who had been on it. So people like Stanfield and people like Equiano were the ones who really knew the terrible truth of these vessels, and their writings had quite an impact.
And you just mentioned Thomas Clarkson, and I want to know a little bit more about him as well. He was a British abolitionist. He was against British, slave trade. Can you tell us a little about him and his role in this abolitionist movement?
Yeah, Thomas Clarkson is really, in my view, vastly more important than was Wilberforce, who is usually the symbolic leader of the slave trade. Clarkson was a young student at Cambridge when he began to read a very small but powerful body of literature created by Quakers, who were the first group actually to turn against the slave trade. Here's where Benjamin Lay comes back in. He wrote a book against slavery in 1738, but Anthony Benezet was sort of one of his followers. He wrote several books and pamphlets, and so these American Quakers had a huge impact on Clarkson, who was the person who convened the first meeting of the Anti-Slave Trade Abolition Society in 1786-87. So Clarkson actually calls together a group to say, let's try to abolish the slave trade, and then we know that slavery will die. Well, it didn't turn out that way. It turns out slavery was able to survive the abolition of the slave trade. But Clarkson himself was a relentless gatherer of information. He traveled thousands upon thousands of miles all around Great Britain to gather information. And the most important things he learned happened on the docks of the slave trading cities. So this is, in fact, in Liverpool, where Clarkson showed up, he was so disliked by the slave trading merchants, he had to have a bodyguard. They actually attempted to kill him once, then attempted to throw him off of a pier. But he managed to prevent that, and then he would thereafter go around armed with a man named Alexander Falconbridge, who was a former physician in a slaving vessel who had subsequently turned against it. So this was kind of an armed battle. So important was this information that Clarkson was gathering. And I'll just give you another example. He found a black sailor by the name of John Dean, and wanted to interview him about his experience. He was living in some poor hovel. I mean, sailors were notoriously poor in this period. And John Dean talked about the way in which the captain had tortured him by flogging him and then dripping liquid lead into the wounds of his back. And he at some point stood up and took off his shirt to show Clarkson what this looked like. And Clarkson was really moved by this story. So Clarkson was kind of he's a very important figure in gathering knowledge, in gathering information, which could then be used in abolitionist publics to make the slave trade real to people. And this, of course, includes the famous drawing of the bodies of Africans carefully arranged on the lower deck of the slave ship, an image that most people have seen. This became a very powerful piece of visual propaganda for the abolitionist movement, because suddenly it allowed people to visualize what the lower deck of a slave ship actually looked like. And when they did that, they were horrified.
And there is another abolitionist, John Newton, but who also wrote a poem called Amazing Grace as an act of penance, but because his story is a bit different because he was a slave trader. He was a slave merchant himself earlier.
Yes, John Newton is known as the author of a very famous hymn, Amazing Grace, which is still sung all over the world, especially and ironically in black churches. People can go to YouTube and see some very powerful renditions of Amazing Grace. And the story that was told about John Newton for many years was that he was involved in the slave trade, and then he had a kind of Christian awakening. He left the sea, and then he became an abolitionist and spoke out against the trade. Well, that's not how it happened. John Newton was a slave ship captain. He went on several voyages. He participated in torturing the enslaved. This we know from his journal. He never actually made a conscious decision to leave the sea. I think it was after his fourth voyage. He was preparing to go out on a fifth voyage, and he had a stroke. So he was no longer able to captain a ship. He had already had his Christian conversion two voyages earlier. So we have correspondence that John Newton wrote from the captain's cabin of a slave ship touting his Christian ideals. So that was not the crucial thing. What happened was, very slowly, once Newton left the sea and became a minister, he began to, you might say, cultivate his doubts. And then about 20 years after he left the sea, he finally came out against it, against the slave trade. And he did participate as a witness in some parliamentary hearings on the slave trade in 1788, 1789, 1790. And as you can imagine, since Newton had captained this slave ship, he knew a lot about what he was talking about. So, and I'll just add this. One of the things that slave ship captains routinely did was to use thumb screws. This is an instrument of torture in which you place somebody's thumbs under a metal loop and turn a key and crush their thumbs. And someone asked Newton during these hearings if he had ever, was it true that slave ship captains used these thumb screws? And Newton's answer was quite deliberately vague. He said, yes, they have been known to be used. What he didn't say was that he himself had used them in the aftermath of a rebellion, trying to force people to confess who the ringleaders of that uprising actually were. So John Newton's story is a complicated one. It's not the kind of a story of Christian grace that you might think, but I do give him credit for becoming an effective voice against the slave trade when he finally turned against it.
Let me ask you a final question. In the light of recent movements such as Black Lives Matter, how is this book relevant to today's day and age? And I'm interested to know more about people who acknowledge slavery, who acknowledge the atrocities of slavery, but they sort of have a dismissive rhetoric saying that, because I tried to listen to many people who were talking about this, especially during Black Lives Matter. They said, like, it's true, but let's look forward. You're so much hung up on the past. They're well-meaning people, but I guess this kind of reductive understanding of the situation as if it's something that happened in isolation 200 years ago and it just vanished into thin air and it's all gone. So what do you think of this kind of rhetoric, and how is this book relevant to us today?
You know, I'm happy to say that the book had a significant surge in sales in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. And as the Black Lives Matter protests were going on in streets all around the world, I mean, we have to remember that that was probably the biggest global anti-racism uprising ever. And it went on all around the world. So the question is, how is history relevant to a powerful contemporary movement that wants to imagine a better future? Well, history means everything because, in fact, we live with the consequences of the slave trade in the United States. I won't speak for other countries. We live with the consequences of the slave trade every minute of every day of our lives. Things that were created during the slave trade are still affecting us. So it's not enough to say that, yeah, the slave trade consisted of a collection of atrocities. It's more than that. This, and as many people around the world are increasingly saying, the slave trade represents a crime against humanity. Now, what's meant by that is a crime against humanity is something that affects many generations after the commission of the original acts. So, therefore, the slave trade ended, well, didn't really end, but in the early 19th century, it went on through much of the 19th century, but we still live with the consequences, such as discrimination, racial discrimination. We live with the idea of deep structural inequality. That also owes a lot to the experience of slavery. We live with premature death. And we live with things like highly racialized incarceration. So I think this history is crucial. We're not going to get anywhere, in my view, unless we take on board this history, the violence, the terror of the slave trade, but also, crucially, the struggle against it, because it was never passively accepted. You know, one of the messages of my book is that even under the most extreme conditions, the people forced onto those slaving vessels did not accept their fate. They did everything they could to fight against it. And I think we have to honor that. And I think if we are going to imagine something better, we've got to deal with this history. One of the conclusions of the book is that reparations are absolutely necessary. But even before reparations, we just have to have basic recognition that it happened. And there is still a tremendous amount of denial in the United States. As you know, there's a big controversy right now about teaching Black history. Conservatives are afraid that the true history might actually be taught and learned and acted on. So they're resorting to censorship of all kinds. And I think this is a, you know, and the reason why this controversy is going on is because we have made real progress in learning about slavery and in teaching about slavery over the past, you know, 6 or 7 decades, inspired by and large by the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement. We have a new history now. And there are a lot of people who are spending a lot of time, first of all, pretending that we don't have that history, and secondly, doing everything they can to censor it. So to me, these are signs of just how important the history is. If it wasn't powerful, people wouldn't be trying to stop it. But it's both powerful and true. And believe me, the overwhelming majority of historians understand these truths about the power of the Atlantic slave system. It's just got to be taught at every level of education and to the general public. And that is one of the reasons I wrote the book. Go ahead and ask.
So before I bring this, before we end this conversation, is there, apart from the play you mentioned, is there any other work that you're currently, any other book project you're currently working on?
Yes. In fact, I'm writing a sequel to The Slave Ship, which is going to be called Freedom Ship. It's about escaping slavery by sea in the period, the 30 years or so before the Civil War, when hundreds, if not thousands, of enslaved people in southern port cities, places like Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, Norfolk, Virginia, got onto vessels with the help of dockers and sailors and market women and other waterfront workers. They managed to get on board these vessels and would be taken to the northern ports where they would gain their freedom. This is, again, our terracentric bias has made us think that the Underground Railroad happened only on land. I actually think that if you look at the total number of people who actually escaped, probably a majority of them did so by sea. So I'm writing the history of this, and it's really a study in self-emancipation. It's a study of the ways that people worked, used lateral connections within the waterfront working class to gain their freedom. And I think this is a story that can help us to understand both the nature of slavery and the resistance to it.
Fascinating. And when is it coming out, and which publisher, if you know?
It's I'll probably finish the book this summer, which means that it would come out in 2024 with Viking Penguin.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope to be able to talk to you about that book next year.
Okay.
Yeah. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed these conversations. It was a great honor for me to be able to talk to you about this wonderful book. And I do strongly encourage our listeners to read the book. It's a very accessible book. The stories are fascinating, and at the same time, sometimes horrifying. But it's a part of the history of human. It's a human history of slavery, an aspect of the slavery that has rarely been talked about. Professor Marcus Redeker, thank you very much for talking to us on New Books Network.
It's been my pleasure, Morteza. Thank you for inviting me.